By evening, Sir Nigel Irvine had secured the agreement he sought. The South Africans would agree to leave Jan Marais in place to give Irvine a chance to mount a major disinformation exercise through George Berenson, assuming he would play ball. The British would keep Marais under total surveillance. It was their responsibility to ensure Marais had no chance to do a moonlight flit to Moscow, since the South Africans now had their own damage assessment to face. 40 years' worth of it. It was further agreed that when the disinformation exercise had run its course, Irvine would inform Pinard that Marais was no longer needed. He would be called home. The British would house him aboard the South African jet, and Pinard's men would make the arrest when the jet was airborne, i.e. on South African sovereign territory. After dinner, Sir Nigel excused himself. His car was waiting. Pinard would spend the night, do some shopping in London's West End the next day, and take the evening flight home. "Just don't let them go," said General Pinard as he saw Sir Nigel off at the door. "I want that bastard back home by the end of the year." "You'll have him," promised Sir Nigel. "Just don't spook him in the meantime." While the head of the NIS was trying to find something in Bond Street for Mrs. Pinard, John Preston was at Charles Street for a meeting with Brian Harcourt Smith. The Deputy Director-General was in his most eager-to-please mood. "Well, John, I gather congratulations are in order. The committee was most impressed by your revelations from South Africa." "Thanks, Brian." "Yes, indeed. It'll all be handled by the committee from now on. Can't say exactly what's to be done, but Tony Plum asked me to pass on his personal sentiments. Now," he spread his hands flat and placed them on his blotter, "to the future." "The future?" "You see, I'm in a bit of a dilemma. You've been on this case for 8 weeks, some of the time out in the street with the watchers, most of it in the basement at Cork, and now South Africa. During all this time, young March, our number two, has been running C1A and doing very well into the bargain. Now, I ask myself, what am I supposed to do with him? I don't think it would be quite fair to bang him back to the two slot. After all, he's been round all the ministries, made some extremely useful suggestions, and a couple of very positive changes." "He would," thought Preston. March was a young, eager beaver, very much one of Harcourt Smith's protégés. "Anyway, I know you've only been at C1A for 10 weeks, and that's pretty short, but seeing as you've covered yourself in glory, it might be a well-judged moment to move on. I've had a word with personnel, and as luck would have it, Cranley at C5C is taking an early retirement at the end of the week. His wife, you know, has not been well for a long time. He wants to take her off the Lake District. So he's taking his pension and leaving. I thought it would suit you." Preston pondered. C5C? "Ports and airports," he queried. It was another liaison job. Immigration, Customs, Special Branch, Serious Crime Squad, Narcotics Squad. They all monitored ports and airports, checking on various kinds of unsavory characters seeking to bring themselves or their illicit cargoes into the country. Preston suspected C5C would have to try to pick up whatever did not fall into anyone else's category. Harcourt Smith raised an admonitory finger. "It's important, John. The special responsibility, of course, is to keep a weather eye open for soft-block illegals and couriers and so forth. It gets one out and about, sort of thing you like." "And away from head office while the struggle for the succession goes on," thought Preston. He knew he was a Bernard Hemmings man down the line, and was aware Harcourt Smith would know it too. He thought of protesting, of demanding a meeting with Sir Bernard to put his case for staying where he was. "Anyway, I want you to give it a try," said Harcourt Smith. "It's still in Gordon, so you won't have to move house." Preston knew he was outmanoeuvred. Harcourt Smith had spent half a lifetime working the head office system. At least, Preston thought, he could be a field man again, even if it was what he termed another policeman's job.
"I'll expect you to start on Monday morning, then," said Harcourt Smith.
On the Friday, Major Valeri Pietrovsky slipped quietly into Britain. He had flown from Moscow to Zurich with a Swedish identity, dropped the whole identity into a sealed envelope addressed to a KGB safe house in the city, and adopted the papers of a Swiss engineer that were waiting for him in another envelope deposited with a post office in the concourse. From Zurich, he connected to Dublin. On the same flight was his escort, who neither knew nor cared what his charge was doing. The escort was simply carrying out his orders. In a room at Dublin's International Airport Hotel, the two men came together. Piotrowski stripped to the skin and handed back the European-style clothes. He put on what the escort had brought in his own hand grip. British clothes from top to toe, plus an overnight case filled with the usual medley of pyjamas, sponge bag, half-read novel, and a change of clothes. The escort had already plucked off the airport's messages board an envelope prepared by the Line N man at the Dublin Embassy and pinned to the notice board 4 hours earlier. It contained a ticket stub for the Oblana Theatre for the previous evening's performance, a receipt for an overnight stay at the New Jury's Hotel for the previous evening in the appropriate name, and the return half of a London-Dublin-London ticket on Aer Lingus. Finally, Piotrowski was handed his new passport. When he went back to the airport concourse and checked in, not an eyebrow was raised. He was an Englishman returning home from a one-day business trip to Dublin. There are no passport checks between Dublin and London. At the London end, arriving passengers must produce their boarding pass or ticket stubs identification. They also pass two blank-eyed special branch men who affect to see nothing and miss very, very little. Neither had ever seen Piotrowski's face because he had never entered Britain by Heathrow Airport before. Had they asked, he could have produced a perfect British passport in the name of James Duncan Ross. It was a passport that could not have been faulted by the passport office itself, for the good and simple reason that the passport office had issued it. Passing through customs without a check, the Russian took a taxi to King's Cross Station. There he went to a left luggage locker. He already had the key. The locker was one of several maintained permanently around the British capital by the Line N man in the embassy, and the key had long been copied. From the locker, the Russian produced a package, sealed exactly as it had arrived in the diplomatic bag at the embassy 2 days earlier. The Line N man had not seen its contents, nor wanted to. He never asked why the package had to be left in a locker in a main station either. It was not his job to. The package Piotrowski slipped unopened into his grip. He could open it at leisure later. He already knew what it contained. From King's Cross he took another taxi across London to Liverpool Street Station, and there boarded the early evening train for Ipswich in the county of Suffolk. Just in time for dinner, he checked into the Great White Horse Hotel. Had any curious policeman insisted on looking inside the package stowed in the hand grip of the young Englishman on the Ipswich train, he would have been amazed. In part, it contained a Finnish Sako automatic pistol with a full magazine, and the nose cone of each round carefully cut in the form of an X. The cuts had been filled with a mixture of gelatine and potassium cyanide concentrate. Not only would they expand on impact with the human body, but recovery from the venom would be out of the question. The other part of the contents consisted of the rest of the legend of James Duncan Ross. A legend, in term of art parlance, is the fictitious life story of a non-existent man, supported by a host of perfectly real documents of every kind and description. Usually the person on whom the legend is built did exist once, but died in circumstances that left no trace and caused no stir. The identity is then taken over and fleshed out, as the skeleton of the dead man can never be, by a supportive documentation going backwards and forwards over the lifespan. The real James Duncan Ross, or what little was left of him, had been rotting in the deep bush of the Zambezi River for years. He had been born in 1950, the son of Angus and Kirsty Ross of Kilbride, Scotland. In 1951, Angus Ross, tired of the cheerless rationing of post-war Britain, had emigrated with his wife and baby son to southern Rhodesia, as it was then called. An engineer, he got a job in agricultural implements and machinery, and by 1960 was able to found his own business. He prospered, being able to send the young James to a good preparatory school and on to Michaelhouse. By 1971, the boy, with his national service behind him, was able to join his father in the company. But this was Ian Smith's Rhodesia now, and the war against the guerrillas of Joshua Nkomo's Zipra and Robert Mugabe's Zandla was getting more vicious. Every able-bodied male was in the reserve, and periods spent back in the army became longer and longer. In 1976, serving with the Rhodesian Light Infantry, James Ross was caught in a Zipra ambush in deep bush on the southern bank of the Zambezi and was killed. The Zipra guerrillas closed in, stripped the body, and vanished back to their bases in Zambia.
He should not have been carrying any identification at all, but just before his patrol set off, he had received a letter from his girlfriend and had stuffed it in his combat jacket pocket. It came back to Zambia and fell into the hands of the KGB. A very senior KGB officer, Vasily Solodovnikov, was then an ambassador to Lusaka, and he ran various networks across all southern Africa. One of them picked up the letter addressed to James Ross, care of his parents' home. The first checks into the deceased young officer produced a bonus. British-born, Angus Ross and his son James had never abandoned their British passports. So the KGB caused James Duncan Ross to live again. When, after Rhodesia became independent, as Zimbabwe, Angus and Kirsty Ross quit for South Africa, James apparently decided to return to Britain. Unseen hands withdrew a copy of his birth certificate from Somerset House in London. Other hands filled out and sent in the postal application for a new passport. Checks were made, and it was granted. In the making of a good legend, scores of people and thousands of hours are expended. The KGB has never lacked the staff or the patience. Bank accounts are opened and closed. Driving licenses carefully renewed before expiry. Cars are bought and sold so that the name shows up on the Vehicle Licensing Center computer. Jobs are taken and promotions earned. References are prepared. Company pension funds topped up. One of the chores of junior intelligence staff is to keep this mass of documentation up to date. Other teams go back into the past. What was the child's nickname? Where did he go to school? What did the boys call the science teacher behind his back? Or what was the family dog called? By the time the legend is complete, and it can take years, and by the time it has been memorized by its new bearer, it would need weeks of investigation to crack it, if at all. This was what Piotrowski carried in his head and hand grip. He was, and could prove he was, James Ross, moving from the West Country to take over the East Anglian representation of a Swiss-based corporation marketing computer software. He had a handsome bank balance at Barclays Bank, Dorchester, Dorset, which he was about to transfer to Colchester. He had mastered the scrawled Ross signature to perfection. Britain is a very private country. Almost alone in the world, the British do not have to carry any personal identification on their persons. If asked, the production of a letter addressed to oneself will usually do, as if that proves anything. A driving license, even though British licenses bear no photograph, is proof positive. A man is expected to be who he says he is. Valery Alexeyevich Piotrowski was perfectly confident, as he dined that night in Ipswich, and rightly so, that no one would doubt he was James Duncan Ross. After dinner, he sought from the reception desk the Yellow Pages commercial directory and turned to the section for estate agents. Chapter 12. While Major Piotrowski was dining at the Great White Horse in Ipswich, the doorbell rang at an apartment on the 8th floor of Fontenoy House in Belgravia. It was opened by the owner, Mr. George Berenson. For a second he stared in surprise at the figure in the corridor. "Good Lord, Sir Nigel." They knew each other vaguely, not so much from shared school days many years before, but from having seen each other occasionally around the Whitehall circuit. The chief of the SIS nodded politely but formally. "Evening, Berenson. Mind if I come in?" Of course, by all means." George Berenson was flustered, though he had no idea of the purpose of the visit. The use by Sir Nigel of his surname, without prefix, indicated the tone of the visit was to be courteous, but by no means chatty. There would be no George and Nigel informality. "Is Lady Fiona in?"
"No, she's gone off to one of her committee meetings. We have the place to ourselves."
Sir Nigel knew that anyway. He had sat in his car and watched Berenson's wife leave before making his approach. Relieved of his coat, but retaining his briefcase, Sir Nigel was shown to a chair in the sitting room, not 10 feet from the by-now-repaired wall safe behind the mirror. Berenson seated himself opposite.
"Well, now, what can I do for you?"
Sir Nigel opened his case and carefully laid 10 photocopies on the glass-topped coffee table. "I think you might, with advantage, have a look at these." Berenson silently studied the top copy.
lifted it to look at the one underneath, and then the third. At the third sheet he stopped and put them down. He had gone very pale, but was still in control of himself. He kept his eyes on the papers.
I don't suppose there's anything I can say.
Not much, said Sir Nigel calmly. They were returned to us some time ago. We know how you came to lose them. Rather bad luck from your point of view. After they were returned, we kept you under surveillance for some weeks, watched the abstraction of the Ascension Island paper, the passing of it to Bonotti, and thence to Marais. It's pretty well tied up, you know.
A little of what he said was provable, but most was pure bluff. He had no wish to let Berenson know just how weak was the legal case against him. The deputy head of defence procurement straightened his back and raised his eyes. Now comes the defiance, thought Irvin, the attempt at self-justification. Funny how they all run to pattern. Berenson met his gaze. The defiance was there.
Well, since you know it all, what are you going to do?
Ask a few questions, said Sir Nigel. For example, how long has it been going on, and why did you start?
Despite his effort at self-control and defiance, Berenson was still confused enough not to have wondered at one very simple point. It was not the duty of the chief of the SIS to have this sort of confrontation. Spies for foreign powers were picked up by counter-intelligence, but his desire to justify himself overcame his capacity for analysis.
As to the first, just over 2 years.
Could be worse, thought Sir Nigel. He knew Marais had been in Britain for almost 3 years, but Berenson might have been run by another South African pro-Soviet sleeper even before that. Apparently not.
As to the second, I would have thought it was obvious.
Let's assume I'm a bit slow, suggested Sir Nigel. So enlighten me. Why?
Berenson drew a deep breath. Perhaps, like so many before him, he had prepared his defence inside his own head often enough, arguing before the courtroom of his own conscience, or what passed for one.
I take the view, and have done for years, that the only struggle on this planet worth a light is the one against communism and Soviet imperialism, he began. In that struggle, South Africa forms one of the bastions, probably the principal bastion, if not the only one, south of the Sahara. For a long time I thought it futile and self-defeating for the Western powers, on dubious moral grounds, to treat South Africa as a leper, to deprive her of any share in our joint planning to respond to the Soviet threat on a global scale. I have believed for years that South Africa has been shabbily treated by the Western powers, that it was both wrong and stupid to exclude her from access to NATO's contingency planning.
Sir Nigel nodded, as if the thought had never occurred to him.
And you thought it right and proper to redress the balance?
Yes, I did. And the Official Secrets Act notwithstanding, I still do.
The vanity, thought Sir Nigel, always the vanity, the monumental self-esteem of inadequate men. Nunn May, Ponte Corvo, Fuchs, Prime, the thread ran through them all. The self-arrogated right to play God, the conviction that the traitor alone is right, and all his colleagues fools, coupled with a drug-like love of power derived from what he sees as the manipulation of policy through the transfer of secrets to the ends in which he believes, and to the confusion of his supposed opponents in his own government, those who have passed him over for promotion or honours.
Tell me, did you begin at your suggestion, or Marais's?
Berenson thought for a while. Jan Marais is a diplomat, so he is beyond your power, he said. There's no harm in my saying. It was at his suggestion. We never met when I was stationed in Pretoria. We met here, just after he had arrived. We found we had a lot in common. He persuaded me that if a time of conflict with the USSR ever came, South Africa would have to stand alone in the Southern Hemisphere, astride the vital routes from the Indian to the South Atlantic Oceans, and probably with Soviet bases strung throughout Black Africa. It seemed to us both that without some indication of how NATO would operate in these two spheres, she would be hamstrung, even though our staunchest ally in these parts.
Powerful argument, nodded Sir Nigel regretfully. You know, when we traced Marais as your controller, I took a risk and put the name straight to General Pinard. He denied Marais had ever worked for him.
Well, he would.
Yes, he would.
but we sent a man down there to check out Pinard's claim. Perhaps you ought to look at his report." He produced from his case the report Preston had brought back from Pretoria, the photograph of the boy Marais clipped to the top. With a shrug, Berenson began to read the 7 foolscap pages. At one point he sucked in his breath sharply, pushed his knuckles into his mouth, and gnawed at one. When he had turned the last page, he put both open hands up to cover his face and rocked slowly back and forth. "Oh, my God," he breathed. "What have I done?" "A hell of a lot of damage, actually," said Sir Nigel. He let Berenson absorb the full measure of his misery without interruption. He sat back and gazed at the destroyed Mandarin without pity. For Sir Nigel, he was just another grubby little traitor who could take a solemn oath to his queen and country, and for his own conceit betray them all. A man of the same degree, if not the scale, of Donald MacLean. Berenson was no longer pale. He was ashen grey. When he took his hands from his face, he had aged by many years.
"Is there anything, anything at all, that I can do?"
Sir Nigel shrugged as if there was little enough that anyone could do. He decided to turn the knife a few more twists. "There's a faction, of course, who want an early arrest. You and Marais. Pretoria has waived. You'd get a middle-class, middle-aged jury. The Crown Council would see to that. Honest people, but not devious. They'd probably never believe in the false flag recruitment at all. We're talking about life. And at your age, that would mean life. In Parkhurst or Dartmoor." He let it sink in for several minutes. "As it happens, I managed to keep the hardline faction at bay for a while. There is another way."
"Sir Nigel, I will do anything. I mean it. Anything."
"How true," thought the chief. "How very true, if only you knew." "Three things, actually," he said out loud. "One, you continue going to the ministry as if nothing had happened. Maintain the usual facade, the usual routines, make not a ripple to disturb the surface of the water. Two, here, in this apartment, after dark, and if necessary through the night, you help us with the damage assessment. The only possible way to mitigate the damage already done is for us to know everything, every single thing that went to Moscow. You withheld one dot or comma, and it'll be porridge and mailbags until you croak." "Yes. Yes, of course. That I can do. I recall every single document that was passed over. Everything. You said three things." "Yes," said Sir Nigel, studying his fingernails. "The third is tricky. You maintain relations with Marais."
"I... what?"
"You don't have to see him. I'd prefer you didn't. I don't think you're enough of an actor to keep up the pretense in his presence. Just the usual contact through coded phone calls when you want to make a delivery." Berenson was genuinely bewildered. "A delivery of what?" "Material that my people, in collaboration with others, will prepare for you. Disinformation, if you like. Apart from your work with the defence people on damage assessment, I want you to collaborate with me. Do some real damage to the Soviets." Berenson grasped as a drowning man at a straw. 5 minutes later, Sir Nigel rose. The damage assessment people would be round after the weekend. He let himself out. As he walked down the corridor to the lift, he was quietly satisfied. He thought of the broken and terrified man he had left behind. "From now on, you bastard. You work for me," he thought. The young girl in the front office at Oxborough's looked up as the stranger entered. She took in his appearance with appreciation. Medium height, compact and fit-looking, with a ready smile, nut-brown hair and hazel eyes. She liked the hazel eyes. "Can I help you?"
"I hope so. I'm new to the district, but I've been told you do lettings of furnished houses."
"Oh, yes. You want to speak to Mr. Knights? He handles houses for rent. What name shall I say?"
He smiled again. "Ross," he said. "James Ross." She depressed a switch and spoke into the intercom.
"There's a Mr. Ross in the office, Mr. Knight, about a furnished house. Can you see him?"
2 minutes later, James Ross was seated in the office of Mr. Knight's. "I've just moved out from Dorset to take over East Anglia for my company," he said easily. "Ideally, I'd like my wife and kids to come up and join me as soon as possible." "Perhaps you're looking to buy a house, then?"
Not just yet.
For one thing, I want to look around for the right house. Then the details tend to take a bit of time. Secondly, I may only be here for a limited period. Depends on head office, you know.
Of course, of course.
Mr. Knight's understood completely. A short lease in the house would help you to get settled while waiting to see if you'd be staying longer.
Exactly, said Ross, in a nutshell.
Furnished or unfurnished?
Furnished, if you have such a thing.
Quite right, said Mr. Knight, reaching for a selection of folders. Unfurnished lettings are almost impossible to come by. You can't always get the people out at the end of the lease. Now, we've got 4 on the books at the moment.
He offered Mr. Ross the brochures.
2 were evidently too large to be plausible for a commercial representative and needed a lot of upkeep. The other 2 were possibles. Mr. Knight's had an hour and drove him to see both. 1 was perfect. A small, neat brick house in a small, neat brick road in a small, neat brick private sector housing estate off the Belstead Road.
It belongs to Mr. Johnson, I believe, said Mr. Knight as they came downstairs. An engineer working on contract in Saudi Arabia for a year, but there's only a 6-month lease left to run.
That should do very well, said Mr. Ross.
It was number 12 Cherry Hayes Close. All the surrounding streets had names ending in Hayes, so that the whole complex was known as simply The Hayes. There was Bracken Hayes, Gorse Hayes, Almond Hayes, and Heather Hayes all around. Number 12, Cherry Hayes, was separated from the pavement by a 6-foot strip of grass, and there was no fence. A single lock-up garage was attached to one side. Piotrowski knew he would need a garage. The back garden was small and fenced, reached through a door from the tiny kitchen. The downstairs contained the glass-panelled front door, which led into a narrow hall. Straight in line with the front door was the staircase to the upper landing. Under the stairs was a broom cupboard. For the rest, there was the single sitting room at the front, and the kitchen down the passage between the stairs and the sitting room door. Upstairs were 2 bedrooms, 1 front and 1 back, and the bathroom toilet. It was inconspicuous and blended with all the other identical brick boxes down the street, themselves occupied by mainly young couples, he in commerce or industry, she coping with the house and 1 or 2 toddlers. The place a man waiting for his wife and children to join him from Dorset at the end of the school term would choose, and not be noticed very much.
I'll take it, he said.
Here we can just go back to the office and sort out the details, said Mr. Knights.
Being a furnished letting, the details were easy. A 2-sheet formal lease to be signed and witnessed, a month's deposit in advance and a month's rent on top. Mr. Ross produced a reference from his employers in Geneva and asked Mr. Knights to call his bank in Dorchester on Monday morning to clear the cheque, which he wrote out there and then. Mr. Knights felt he could have the paperwork sorted to everyone's satisfaction by Monday evening if the cheque and the references were in order. Ross smiled. They would be, he knew.
Alan Fox was also in his office that Saturday morning at the special request of his friend Sir Nigel Irvin, who had called to say he needed a meeting. The English knight was ushered up the stairs at the American Embassy shortly after 10 o'clock. Alan Fox was the local head of station for the American CIA, and he went back a long way. He had known Nigel Irvin for 20 years.
"I'm afraid we seem to have come across a small problem," said Sir Nigel when he was seated. "One of our civil servants in the Defence Ministry turns out to have been a bad egg."
"Oh, for Christ's sake, Nigel, not another leak," expostulated Fox.
Irvin looked apologetic. "I'm afraid that's what it has to be," he admitted. "Something rather like your Harper affair."
Alan Fox winced. The blow had struck home. Back in 1983, the Americans had been badly hurt on discovering that an engineer working in Silicon Valley, California, had blown to the Poles, and thence to the Russians, a vast tract of secret information about the U.S. Minuteman missile systems. Along with the earlier Boyce spying case, the Harper affair had leveled the score somewhat. The British had long tolerated rib-tickling references from the Americans about Philby, Burgess and Maclean, not to mention Blake, Vassal, Blunt and Prime, and even after all those years the stigma still stuck. Yet it almost made the British feel a bit better when the Americans had 2 bad ones over Boyce and Harper. At least other people had traitors as well.
"Ouch," said Fox. "That's what I've always liked about you, Nigel. You can't see a belt without wanting to hit below it."
Fox was known in London for his acerbic wit. He had made his mark at an early meeting of the Joint Intelligence Committee when Sir Anthony Plum had been complaining that, unlike all the others, he had no nice little acronym to describe his job. He was just the chairman of the JIC, or the Coordinator of Intelligence. Why could he not have a group of initials that made up a short word in themselves? How about, drawled Fox from his end of the table, Supreme Head of Intelligence Targeting? Sir Anthony preferred not to be known as the Shit of Whitehall and dropped the matter of the acronym. Okay, so how bad is it? Fox asked. Not as bad as it might be, said Sir Nigel, and told Fox the story from beginning to end. The American leaned forward with interest. You mean he's really been turned right around? He's going to pass over just what he's told? It's either that or the rest of his life eating prison porridge. He'll be under surveillance all the time. Of course, he may have a warning code for Murray that he can slip into a phone call, but I think not. He really is of the extreme right, and it was a false flag recruitment. Fox pondered for a while. How high do you reckon the Center rates this Berenson, Nigel?
We start damage assessment on Monday, said Irvin. But I think, in view of his eminence in the ministry, he must be rated very high in Moscow, maybe even a director's case.
Could we pass some of our disinformation down the same line? Asked Fox. His mind could already see some useful ploys that Langley would love to pass to Moscow.
I don't want to overload the circuits, said Nigel. The rhythm of the staff passed over must be maintained, as well as the type of stuff, but yes, we could cut you in on this one.
And you want me to persuade my people to go easy on London? Sir Nigel shrugged.
The damage that has been done is done. It's very good for the ego to make a hell of a fuss, but non-productive. I'd like us to rectify the damage and inflict some of our own.
Okay, Nigel, you've got it. I'll tell our people to back off. We get the damage assessment right off the presses, and we'll prepare a couple of pieces about our nuclear subs in the Atlantic and Indian Oceans that will make the Senator look the wrong way. I'll stay in touch.
On Monday morning, Piotrowski rented a small and modest family saloon from an agency in Colchester. He explained that he was from Dorchester and was house-hunting in Essex and Suffolk. His own car was with his wife and family in Dorset, which was why he did not wish to buy a car for such a short spell. His driving license was in perfect order, with a Dorchester address. Insurance, of course, came with the rental. He wished for a long-term rental, possibly up to 3 months, and opted for the budget plan. He paid a week's rental in cash and left a cheque for the month after that. The next problem was going to be harder and would need the services of an insurance broker. He located and visited such a broker in the same town and explained his position. He had worked abroad for some years and prior to that had always driven a company car. As such, he had no regular insurance company in Britain. Now he had decided to return home and start up on his own account. He would need to purchase a vehicle, and for that would need insurance cover. Could the broker assist him? The broker would be delighted. He assured himself the new client had a spotless driving license, an international driving license, a solid and respectable appearance, and a bank account, which even that morning had been transferred from Dorchester to Colchester. What sort of vehicle did he intend to buy? A motorcycle? Yes, indeed, so much easier in dense traffic. Of course, in the hands of teenagers, these were difficult to insure, but a mature, professional man, no problem. Comprehensive would be a bit difficult, perhaps. The client would settle for third party only. And the address? House hunting at the moment, quite understandable, but staying at the Great White Horse in Ipswich, perfectly acceptable. Then, if Mr. Ross would inform him of the registration number of his motorcycle when he made the purchase, and any change of address, he was sure he could secure third-party insurance cover in 1 or 2 days.
Piotrowski returned in his rented car to Ipswich. It had been a busy day, but he was satisfied he had raised no suspicions, and yet left behind no pursuable trace of himself. The car rental agency and the hotel had been given an address in Dorchester that did not exist. Oxborough's, the estate agents, and the insurance broker had the hotel as a temporary address, and Oxborough's knew about number 12, Cherry Hayes. Barclays Bank in Colchester also had the hotel as his address while he was house-hunting. He would retain the room at the hotel until he had secured his insurance cover from the broker, then leave. The idea that any of these parties would ever be able to get in touch with each other was remote in the extreme.
Apart from Oxborough's, the trail stopped at the hotel, or at a non-existent in Dorchester. So long as payments were kept up on the house and the car, so long as the insurance broker got a valid cheque for 1 year's premium on the motorcycle, none of them would think anything of him. Barclays at Colchester had been told to send him statements once a quarter, but by the end of June he would be long gone. He returned to the estate agents to sign the lease and complete the formalities. That Monday evening, the spearhead of the damage assessment team arrived at George Berenson's apartment in Belgravia to begin their work. It was a small group of MI5 experts and Defence Ministry analysts. The first task was identification of every single document that had passed to Moscow. They had with them copies of the registry files, withdrawals and returns in case Berenson's memory failed him. Later, other analysts, basing their studies on the list of documents passed, would try to assess and mitigate the damage done, proposing what could still be changed, what plans would have to be cancelled, what tactical and strategic dispositions would have to be annulled, and which could stay in place. They worked through the night, and were later able to report that Berenson had been cooperation itself. What they thought of him privately did not form part of their report, since it was unprintable. Another team, working deep inside the ministry, began to prepare the next batch of classified documents that Berenson would pass to Jan Marais and his controllers, somewhere inside the first chief directorate at Yasyenova. John Preston moved into his new office as head of C5C on the Wednesday, bringing his personal files with him. Fortunately, he was moving up only one floor to the third at Gordon. As he sat at his desk, his eye caught sight of the calendar on the wall. It was the 1st of April, April Fool's Day. Not very appropriate, he thought bitterly. The only ray on his horizon was the knowledge that in just over a week his son Tommy would be home for the Easter vacation. They would have a full week together before Julia, back from skiing with her boyfriend at Verbier, would claim him for the rest of the holiday. For a whole week, his small Kensington flat would reverberate to the sound of 12-year-old enthusiasms, to tales of prowess on the rugby field, jokes played upon the French master, and the need for further supplies of jam and cake for illegal consumption after lights out in the dormitory. He smiled at the prospect and resolved to take at least 4 days off. He had planned a few good father and son expeditions and hoped they would meet with Tommy's approval. He was interrupted by Jeff Bright, his deputy head of section. Bright, he knew, would have had his job, except that his youth simply did not make it possible. He was another of Harcourt Smith's protégés, happy and flattered to be invited regularly for a quiet drink by the Deputy Director-General and to report everything that went on in the section. He would go far under the forthcoming Director-Generalship of Harcourt Smith. "I thought you might like to see the list of the ports and airports we have to keep an eye on, John," said Bright. Preston studied the lists put before him. Were there really that number of airports with flights originating or terminating outside the British Isles? And the list of ports able to receive commercial cargo vessels arriving from foreign ports went on for pages. He sighed and started to read. The following day, Pietrovsky found what he was looking for. Operating on a policy of making different purchases in different towns in the Suffolk-Essex area, he had gone to Stowmarket. The motorcycle was a BMW shaft drive K100, not new but in excellent condition, a big, powerful machine, 3 years old but with only 22,000 miles on the clock. The same shop also stocked the accessories, black leather trousers and jacket, gauntlets, zip-sided jack boots and crash helmets with dark slide-down visors. He bought a complete outfit. A 20% deposit secured him the motorcycle, but not to take away. He asked for panniers to be fitted outside the rear wheel, with a lockable fiberglass box on top of them, and was told he could collect the machine in 2 days. From a phone booth he called the insurance broker in Colchester and gave him the registration number of the BMW. The broker was confident he could have his temporary 30-day insurance cover note by the next day. He would mail it to the Great White Horse Hotel in Ipswich. From Stowmarket, Pietrovsky motored north to Thetford, just over the county border in Norfolk. There was nothing particular about Thetford. It just lay approximately in the line he needed. He found what he wanted just after lunch. In Maudlin Street, between No. 13A and the Salvation Army Hall, is a recessed rectangular yard containing 31 lock-up garages. One had a to-let notice stuck on its door. He traced the owner, who lived locally, rented the garage for 3 months, paying for it in cash and giving a fictitious name and address, and was given the key. The garage was small, but would serve his purpose admirably. He hung up his motorcycle leathers, helmet and boots, and during what remained of the afternoon bought 2 10-gallon plastic drums from 2 different shops, filled them with petrol at 2 different garages, and stored them in his lock-up. At sundown, he motored back to Ipswich, telling the hotel receptionist that he would check out the following morning. Preston realized he was becoming bored to the point of distraction. He had only been in the job 2 days, and they had been spent reading files. He sat over lunch in the canteen and seriously thought of taking early retirement. That presented 2 problems. It would not be easy for a man in his mid-40s to get good employment, and more so as his arcane qualifications were hardly the type that the big corporations would find of irresistible interest. The second concern was his loyalty to Sir Bernard Hemmings. He had been in the service only 6 years, but the old man had been very good to him. He liked Sir Bernard, and he knew the knives were out for the ailing Director General. The ultimate decision in the choice of the head of MI5 or the chief of MI6 in Britain lies with a committee of the so-called wise men. For MI5, these would normally be the permanent Under-Secretary of the Home Office, the ministry controlling MI5, plus the PUS at Defence and the Cabinet Secretary and the Chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee. These would recommend a favoured candidate to the Home Secretary and Prime Minister, the 2 senior politicians involved. It would be rare for the politicians to decline the recommendation of the wise men. But before they would make a decision, the mandarins would take soundings in their own inimitable way. There would be discreet lunches in clubs, drinks at bars, murmured discussions over coffee. In the case of the proposed Director-General of MI5, the chief of the SIS would be consulted, but, as in this case, Sir Nigel Irvine was himself moving close to retirement, he would have to have a very good reason to advise against a leading candidate for the other intelligence service. After all, he would not have to work with the man. Among the most influential of the sources sounded out by the wise men would be the outgoing DG of MI5 himself. Preston knew that an honourable man like Sir Bernard Hemmings would feel bound to take a straw poll of his own heads of section throughout the 6 branches of the service. That straw poll would weigh heavily with him, whatever his personal feelings might be. Not for nothing had Brian Harcourt Smith used his increasing predominance in the day-to-day running of the service to place one of his protégés after another at the head of the numerous sections. Preston was in no doubt Harcourt Smith would like him to leave before the autumn, along with 2 or 3 others who had gone into civilian life over the past 12 months. "Sod him," he remarked to no one in particular in a largely empty canteen. "I'll stay." While Preston was at lunch, Piotrowski left the hotel, his luggage by now increased by a large suitcase full of clothes that he had bought locally. He told the receptionist that he would be moving to the Norfolk area, and that any mail arriving for him should be held pending collection. He rang the insurance broker in Colchester to learn that the temporary cover note for the motorcycle had been issued. The Russian asked the broker not to mail it, he would collect it himself. This he did immediately, and late that afternoon moved into No. 12 Cherry Hayes. He spent part of the night working carefully with his one-time pads, preparing a coded message that no computer would break. Code-breaking, he knew, is based on patterns and repetitions, however sophisticated the computer used to crack the code. Using a one-time pad for each word of a short message leaves no patterns and no repetitions. On the Saturday morning he drove to Thetford, garaged his car, and took a local taxi to Stowmarket. Here, with a certified cheque, he paid the balance on the price of the BMW, borrowed the toilet to change into his leathers and crash helmet, which he had brought in a canvas grip, stuffed the grip and his ordinary jacket, trousers and shoes into the panniers, and rode away. It was a long ride, and took him many hours. It was not until late evening that he arrived back at Thetford, changed clothes, exchanged motorcycle for family saloon, and motored sedately back to Cherry Hayes Close, Ipswich, arriving at midnight. He was not observed, but had he been, it would have been as that nice young Mr. Ross who had moved into number 12 on Friday.
On a Saturday evening, United States Master Sergeant Averill Cook would have preferred to be dating his girlfriend in nearby Bedford, or even playing pool with friends in the commissary. Instead, he was taking the swing shift at the joint British-American listening station at Chicksands. The head office of the British Electronic Monitoring and Code-Breaking Complex is at the Government Communications HQ at Cheltenham, Gloucestershire, in the south of England. But GCHQ has outstations in various parts of the country, and one of them, Chicksands in Bedfordshire, is run jointly by GCHQ and the American National Security Agency. The days when attentive men sat hunched into earphones trying to pick up and record the manual tapping of a Morse key operated by some German agent in Britain are long gone. In the business of listening, analysing, filtering the innocent from the not-so-innocent, recording the latter and decoding, computers have taken over. Master Sergeant Cook was confident, and rightly so, that if any of the forest of aerials above him picked up an electronic whisper, it would pass that whisper to the banks of computers below. The scanning of the bands was automatic, the recording of any whisper in the ether that should not be there equally automatic. If such a whisper occurred, the eternally watchful computer would trigger its own hit button deep inside its own multicoloured entrails, record the transmission, take an immediate bearing on its source, instruct other brother computers across the country to take a cross-bearing, and alert him. At 11:43, something caused the master computer to operate its own hit button. Something, or someone, had transmitted what was not expected, and out of the whirling kaleidoscope of electronic signals that fill the air of this planet 24 hours in every day, the computer had noticed and traced it. Master Sergeant Cook noted the warning signal and reached for a telephone. What the computer had picked up was a squirt, a brief shriek of sound that lasted only a few seconds and would make no sense to the human ear. A squirt is the end product of quite a laborious procedure in the sending of clandestine messages. First, the message is written out in clear and as brief as possible. Then it is encoded, but it still remains a list of letters or figures. The encoded message is tapped out on a Morse key, not to a listening world, but to a tape machine. The tape is then speeded up to an extreme degree, so that the dots and dashes that make up the transmission are telescoped to emerge as a single screech lasting only a few seconds. When the transmitter is ready to go, the operator simply sends that single screech, then packs up his set and moves sharply somewhere else. Within 10 minutes, that Saturday night, the triangulators had pinpointed the spot from which the screech had come. Other computers at Menwith Hill in Yorkshire and Brodie in Wales had also caught the brief squirt transmission and taken a bearing. When the local police got there, the spot turned out to be a lay-by on a lonely road high in the Derbyshire Peak District. There was no one there. In due course, the message went to Cheltenham and was slowed down to a pace at which the dots and dashes could be transcribed into letters. But after 24 hours going through the electronic brains, called the code breakers, the answer was still a big zero. "It's a sleeper transmitter, probably somewhere in the Midlands, and he's gone to active," the chief analysis reported to the Director General of GCHQ. "But our man seems to be using a fresh one-time pad for every word. Unless we can have a lot more of it, we won't break it." It was decided to keep a close watch on the channel the secret sender had used, though if he broadcast again, he would almost certainly use a different channel. A brief, flimsy recording of the incident went to the desks, among others, of Sir Bernard Hemmings and Sir Nigel Irvine. The message had been received elsewhere, notably in Moscow. Decoded with a replica set of the one-time pads used in a quiet backwater of Ipswich, the message told those interested that the man on the ground had completed all his preliminary tasks ahead of schedule,
and was ready to receive his first courier.
Chapter 13. The spring thaw would not be long in coming, but for the moment crusted snow hung on the branches of the birch and fir trees far below. From the spectacular double-glazed window on the seventh and top floor of the first chief directorate building at Yasyenova, the man gazing out at the landscape could make out, across the sea of winter trees, the tip of the western end of the lake, where in summer the foreign diplomats from Moscow like to come and disport themselves. That Sunday morning, Lieutenant General Yevgeny Sergeyevich Karpov would have preferred to be with his wife and teenage children at their dacha at Peredelkino, but even when one has risen as high in the service as Karpov, there are some things that have to be taken care of personally. The arrival of the bagman due home from Copenhagen was such a matter. He glanced at his watch. It was nearly noon and the man was late. Turning from the window, he sighed and threw himself into the easy swivel chair behind his desk. At 57, Yevgeny Karpov was at the pinnacle of promotion and power achievable by a professional intelligence officer within the KGB, or at least within the first chief directorate. Fyodorchuk had gone higher, right up to the chairmanship itself, and onto the MVD, but that had been on the general secretary's coattails. Moreover, Fyodorchuk had not been FCD. He had rarely left the Soviet Union. He had made his bones crushing internal dissident and nationalist movements. But for a man who had spent years serving his country abroad, all was a minus in terms of promotion to the highest offices in the Union, Karpov had done well. A lean, fit-looking man in a beautifully cut suit, one of the perks of being FCD, he was a full lieutenant general and first deputy head of the first chief directorate. As such, he was the highest-ranking professional I.O. in foreign intelligence, the equivalent of the deputy directors of operations and intelligence at the CIA and of Sir Nigel Irvine at the British SIS. Years earlier, on his accession to power, the General Secretary had plucked Fyodorchuk out of the chairmanship of the KGB to overlord the Interior Ministry, and General Chebrikov had gone to replace him. It had left a slot vacant. Chebrikov had been one of the two first deputy chairmen. The vacant post of first deputy chairman had been offered to Colonel General Kryuchkov, who had jumped at it. The trouble was, Kryuchkov was then head of the FCD, and he did not want to relinquish that powerful post. He wanted to hold both posts together. Even Kryuchkov had realized, and Karpov privately thought the man as thick as two short planks, that he could not be in two places at once. He could not be in his first deputy chairman's office at the centre in Dzerzhinsky Square and in the office of the head of the FCD out at Yasyenova at the same time. What happened was that the post of first deputy head of the FCD, which had existed for years, increased substantially in importance. It had already been a job for an officer of considerable operational experience, indeed the highest in the FCD to which a career officer could aspire. With Kryuchkov no longer a resident at the village, KGB house jargon for Yasyenova, the job of his first deputy had become even more important. When the incumbent, General B.S. Ivanov, retired, there were two possible candidates in line to succeed. Karpov, then a bit young, but heading up the important third department and room 6013, the department covering Britain, Australia, New Zealand and Scandinavia, and Vadim Vasilyevich Kirpichenko, rather older, a bit senior and heading for the S, or Illegals Directorate. Kirpichenko had got the job. As a sort of consolation prize, Karpov had been promoted to be head of the powerful Illegals Directorate, a post he had held for two fascinating years. Then, in the early spring of 1985, Kirpichenko had done the decent thing. Speeding down the Sadovaya Spaskaya ring road at close to 100, his car had clipped a pool of oil left by a leaking truck and had gone completely out of control. A week later, there had been a quiet, private ceremony at Novodevichy Cemetery, and a week after that, Karpov had got the job, rising from Major General to Lieutenant General. He had been happy to hand the Illegals Directorate over to old Borisov, who had been number two there for so long few cared to remember just how many years it had been, and who deserved the job anyway. The phone on his desk rang, and he snatched it up. "Comrade Major General Borisov on the line for you." "Speak of the devil," he thought.
Then he frowned. He had a private line that did not pass through the switchboard, and his old colleague had not used it. Must be phoning from outside, telling his secretary to bring the bagman from Copenhagen to him the moment he arrived. He depressed the outside line switch and took Borisov's call. "Pavel Petrovich, how are you this fine day?"
"I tried you at home, then at the Dacha. Lyudmila said you're at work."
"So I am. It's all right for some."
Karpov was gently pulling the older man's leg. Borisov was a widower, lived alone, and put in more working weekends than almost anyone else. "Evgeny Sergeyevich, I need to see you."
"Of course, you don't need to ask."
"You want to come over here tomorrow, or shall I come into town? Could you make it today?"
Even odder, thought Karpov.
Something must have got into the old boy. He sounded as though he might have been drinking.
"Have you been on the bottle, Pavel Petrovich?"
"Maybe I have," said a truculent voice down the line. "Maybe a man needs a few drams now and again, especially when he has problems."
Karpov realized that, whatever it was serious. He dropped the bantering tone.
"All right, Storyets," he said soothingly.
"Where are you?"
"You know my cottage."
"Of course. You want me to come out there?"
"Yes, I'd be grateful," said Borisov.
"When can you make it?"
"Say about 6, proposed Karpov. "I'll have a bottle of pepper vodka ready," said the voice, and Borisov hung up.
"Not on my account," muttered Karpov.
Unlike most Russians, Karpov hardly drank at all, and when he did, he preferred a decent Armenian brandy or a Scotch single malt, which came to him personally in the bag from London. Vodka he regarded as an abomination, and pepper vodka even worse. "Bang goes my Sunday afternoon at Peredelkino," he thought, and rang to tell Lyudmila he could not make it. He made no mention of Borisov, just told her that he could not get away and that he would see her at the central Moscow apartment about midnight. Still, he was perturbed by Borisov's unusual truculence. They went back a long way together, too long for him to take offence, but it was odd in a man habitually so genial and phlegmatic. That Sunday afternoon, the regular Aeroflot service from Moscow came into London's Heathrow Airport just after 5. As with all Aeroflot crews, there was one member who worked for 2 masters, the Soviet state airline and the KGB. First Officer Romanov was not a KGB staffer, just a gent, meaning an informer upon his colleagues and, from time to time, a runner of messages and errands. The whole crew closed the aircraft down and left it in the hands of the ground staff for the night. They would fly it back to Moscow the next day. As usual, they went through the flight crew entry procedures, and customs gave a cursory check of the shoulder bags and grips. Several had their own portable transistor radios, and no one took any notice of Romanov's Sony model on its shoulder strap. Western luxury items were part of the perks of foreign travel for a Soviet citizen. Everyone knew that. And although they had an extremely tight foreign currency allowance, cassettes and players, along with radios and perfume for the wife back in Moscow, were among the top priorities. After clearing immigration and customs formalities, the whole crew boarded their minibus for the Green Park Hotel, where Aeroflot crews often stay. Whoever had given Romanov that transistor radio in Moscow just 3 hours before takeoff must have known that Aeroflot crews are hardly ever shadowed at Heathrow. The British counterintelligence people seem to accept that, though they may constitute a risk, it must be a tolerable one compared to the mounting of a pretty major surveillance operation. When he got to his bedroom, Romanov could not help looking at the radio with curiosity. Then he shrugged, locked it in his case, and went down to the bar to join the other officers in a drink. He knew exactly what to do with it after breakfast the next day. He would do it, then forget all about it. He did not know that, on his return to Moscow, he would be going straight into quarantine. Karpov's car crunched up the snow-clogged track just before 6, and he cursed Borisov's insistence on having his weekend cottage in such a forsaken place. Everyone in the service knew Borisov was a one-off. In a society that regards all individualism or deviation from the norm, not to mention eccentricity, as extremely suspect, Borisov got away with it because he was unusually good at his job. He had been in clandestine intelligence since he was a boy, and some of the coups he had mounted against the West were legendary in the training schools and the canteens where the junior men took their lunches. After half a mile down the track, Karpov could make out the lights of the log cabin, or izba, that Barisa favoured for his weekend retreat. Others were content, even eager, to sight their weekend places in the approved zones according to their station in the pecking order, and those zones were all west of Moscow along the curve of the river across the Uspenskaya Bridge. Not Borisov. Well east of the capital, deep in the forests, he liked to retire at the weekends, or those when he could get away from his desk, to play rustic peasant in a traditional izba. The chaika came to a halt in front of the timber door. "Wait here," Karpov told his driver.
"I'd better turn around and get some of those logs under the wheels, or we'll stick solid," grumbled Misha.
Karpov nodded his agreement and climbed out. He had not brought galoshes because he had not envisaged wading through snow up to the knees. He stumbled to the door and hammered on it. The door opened to reveal an oblong of yellow light, thrown apparently by paraffin lamps, and in the space stood Major General Pavel Petrovich Borisov, dressed in a Siberian shirt, cord trousers, and felt boots.
"You look like something out of a Tolstoy novel," remarked Karpov as he was shown into the main sitting room, where a brick stove full of logs gave the cottage a womb-like warmth.
"Better than something out of a Bond Street window," grumbled Borisov as he took Karpov's coat and hung it on a wooden peg. He uncorked a bottle of vodka so strong it poured like syrup and filled two shot glasses. The men seated themselves, a table between them. "Bottoms up!" Karpov raised his glass, Russian style, between forefinger and thumb, pinky extended.
"Up yours," replied Borisov, and they drained the first slug.
An old peasant woman, shaped like a tea-cosy, blank face and grey hair in a tight bun, like an incarnation of Mother Russia, came in from the back, banged down a collation of black bread, onions, gherkins, and cheese cubes, and left without a word.
"So, what's the problem, Staryets?"
asked Karpov. Borisov was 5 years older than himself, and not for the first time he was struck by the man's spitting image to the late Dwight Eisenhower. Karpov knew he was, unlike many in the service, much liked by his colleagues and adored by his young agents. They had long given him the affectionate nickname Staryets, a word once meaning a Russian village headman, but now more like the old man or le patron. Borisov stared at him moodily across the table.
"Yevgeny Sergeyevich, how long have we known each other?"
"More years than I care to remember," said Karpov.
"And in that time have I ever lied to you?"
"Not that I know of." Karpov was pensive.
"And are you now going to lie to me?"
"Not if I can help it," said Karpov carefully. What on earth had got into the old boy?
"Then what the hell are you doing to my department?"
demanded Borisov loudly. Karpov considered the question carefully.
"Why don't you tell me what is happening to your department?" he countered. "It's being stripped, that's what," snarled Borisov. "You have to be behind it, or aware of it. How the hell am I supposed to run the S operation when my best men, my best documents, and my best facilities are being stripped from me? Bloody years of hard work, all confiscated in a matter of days."
He had had his explosion, the thing he had bottled up until now. Karpov sat back, lost in thought, while Borisov topped up the glasses. He had not risen as high as he had within the labyrinthine corridors of the KGB without developing a sixth sense for danger. Borisov was no alarmist. There had to be something behind what he said, but Karpov quite genuinely did not know what it was. He leaned forward.
"Paul Petrovich,"
he said, dropping into the very familiar diminutive of Pavel. "As you say, we have been around for a good many years. Believe me, I don't know what you're talking about. Will you please stop shouting and tell me?" Borisov was mollified, albeit puzzled, by Karpov's assurance of ignorance.
"All right," he said, as if explaining the obvious to a child. "First, two goons arrive from the Central Committee and demand that I hand over to them my best illegal, a man I've spent years training personally and of whom I had the greatest hopes. They say he has to be detached for special duties, whatever that may mean. Okay, I give them my best man. I don't like it, but I do it. 2 days later, they're back.
They want my best legend, a legend that took over 10 years to put together. Not since that damn Iranian affair have I been treated like that. You remember the Iranian business. I'm still not recovered from that.
Karpov nodded. He had not been with the Illegals Directorate then, but Borisov had told him about it all when they worked together during his 2-year tenure of the directorship of the Illegals. In the last days of the Shah of Iran, the International Department of the Central Committee had decided it would be a nice idea to spirit the entire Politburo of the Iranian Tudeh, Communist Party, out of Iran covertly. They had raided Borisov's magpie-hoarded files and confiscated 22 perfect Iranian legends, cover stories Borisov had been saving to send people into Iran, not get them out.
"Stripped to the bone," he had screamed at the time, "just to get those flea-bitten wogs to safety."
Later he had complained to Karpov. "It didn't do them much good either. The Ayatollah's in charge, the Tudeh is still banned, and we can't even mount an operation in there anymore."
Karpov knew that affair still rankled, but the new business was more odd. For one thing, the demand should have come through him.
"Who did you give them?" he asked.
"Pietrovsky," said Borisov resignedly. "I had to. They asked for the best, and he was way ahead of the others. Remember Pietrovsky?"
Karpov nodded. He had only headed the Illegals for 2 years, but he recalled all their best names and ongoing operations. In his present post, he had total access anyway. Whose authority was on these indents?
"Well, technically the Central Committee, but from the authority rating..."
Borisov pointed a rigid finger at the ceiling and, by inference, the sky.
"God?"
queried Karpov.
"Almost. Our beloved General Secretary. At least that's my guess."
"Anything else?"
"Yep. Just after the legend, the same clans are back again. That time they took the receiver crystal of one of the covert transmitters you seeded into England 4 years ago. That was why I thought it was all down to you."
Karpov's eyes narrowed. When he had been director of the Illegals, the NATO countries had been deploying Pershing II and cruise missiles. Washington had been running around the world trying to reenact the last reel of every John Wayne movie ever written, and the Politburo had been worried sick. He had received orders to upgrade the Illegals' contingency planning for massive behind-the-line sabotage operations in Western Europe, for use in the event of any actual outbreak of hostilities. To fulfil this order, he had seeded a number of clandestine radio transmitters into Western Europe, including 3 into Britain. The men guarding the sets and trained to operate them were all sleepers, ordered to lie low until activated by an agent with the proper identification codes. The sets were ultra-modern, scrambling their messages as they were transmitted, and to unscramble the message, the receiving set would need a programmed crystal. These were stored in a safe in the Illegals' directorate.
"Which transmitter?" he inquired. "The one you always called Poplar."
Karpov nodded. He knew all operations, agents, and assets had official code names, but he had been a specialist in Britain for so long and knew London so well that he had private code names for his own operation, and they were based in London districts whose names had 2 syllables. The 3 transmitters he had caused to be placed in Britain were, for him, Hackney, Shoreditch, and Poplar.
"Any more, Paul Pietrovich?" "Sure. These guys are never satisfied. The last one they took was Igor Volkov."
Major Volkov, formerly of the Executive Action Department, until the Politburo had decided straight hit jobs were becoming too embarrassing, and the Bulgars and East Germans should be told to do the dirty work. Then Department V, or Executive Action, had gone in for more sabotage.
"What's his speciality?" "Bringing clandestine packages through state borders, particularly in Western Europe."
"Smuggling?"
"All right, smuggling. He's good. He knows more about the borders in that part of the world, the customs and immigration procedures, and how to get round them than anyone else we've got. Well, had, I should say. They took him, too."
Karpov rose and leaned forward, placing both hands on the older man's shoulders.
"Look, Staryets, I give you my word, this is not my operation. I didn't even know about it. But we both know it has to be very big, and that means it's dangerous to start poking around. Stay cool, bite on the bullet, absorb your losses.
I'll try and find out quietly what is going on and when you can have your assets back. For your part, stay buttoned up. Tighter than a Georgian's purse, okay? Borisov raised both his hands, palms forward, in a gesture of innocence. You know me, Evgeny Sergeyevich. I'm going to die the oldest man in Russia. Karpov laughed. He pulled on his coat and made for the door. Borisov followed to see him out. I think you will, too, said Karpov. When the door was closed behind him, Karpov tapped on his driver's window. Follow me until I want to get in, he said. He started to walk down the snowy track, oblivious of the ice that clung to his town shoes and worsted trousers. The freezing night air was refreshing on the face, driving away some of the vodka fumes, and he needed a clear head to think. What he had learned had made him very angry indeed. Someone, and he had few doubts who it might be, was mounting a private operation in Britain. Apart from the massive snub to the first deputy head of the first chief directorate, he, Karpov, had spent so many years in Britain, or running agents within it, that he regarded it as his private preserve. As General Karpov walked down the track, lost in thought, a phone rang in a small flat in Highgate, London, not 500 yards from the tomb of Karl Marx. "Are you there, Barry?" a woman's voice called from the kitchen. From the sitting room a male voice called back. "Yes, I'll get it." The man walked to the hall and took the phone while his wife continued preparing their Sunday dinner.
"Barry?"
"Speaking."
"Ah, sorry to disturb you on a Sunday evening. It's C."
"Oh, evening, sir." Barry Banks was surprised. It was not unheard of, but not frequent, that the master called one of his people at home.
"Look, Barry, what time do you normally get into Charles Street in the morning?"
"About 10, sir."
"Could you leave an hour earlier tomorrow and drop by Sentinel to have a word with me?"
"Yes, of course."
"Good. Then I'll see you about 9.
Barry Banks was K7 at the Charles Street headquarters of MI5, but he was actually an MI6 man whose job was to act as Sir Nigel Irvin's link with the security service. He wondered idly, as he ate the supper his wife had prepared for him, what Sir Nigel Irvin could want, and why it had to be asked out of hours. Yevgeny Karpov had not a shred of doubt that a secret operation had been mounted and was being carried out, and that it concerned Britain. Pietrovsky, he knew, was an expert at passing for a Britisher right in the heart of that country. The legend that had been abstracted from Borisov's files fitted Pietrovsky to a T. The Poplar transmitter was hidden away in the North Midlands of England. If Volkov had been transferred because of his speciality in bringing packages into Britain, there must be other transfers already made, but from different directorates outside Borisov's orbit. All of which pointed unswervingly to the likelihood that Pietrovsky would be going to Britain under deep cover, or had already gone. Nothing strange in that. It was what he'd been trained for. What was strange was that the first chief directorate, in the form of himself, had been kept rigorously out of the operation. It made little sense, bearing in mind his own personal expertise in Britain and British affairs. He went back 20 years in his connection with Britain. Since that evening in September 1967, when he had been trawling in the bars of West Berlin, frequented by off-duty British service personnel. As a keen and rising illegal, it was his assignment at the time. His eye had fallen on a morose, sour-looking young man further down the bar, whose civilian suit and haircut had said, British Armed Forces. He moved in on the lonely drinker and discovered he was a 29-year-old radio operator with a signals intelligence, i.e. monitoring, unit, serving with the Royal Air Force at Gatow. He was also thoroughly discontented with his lot in life. Between that September and January 1968, Karpov had worked on the RAF man, first pretending to be a German, as was his cover, and then admitting he was a Russian. It was an easy pull, so easy it was almost suspect, but it was genuine, all right. The Englishman was flattered to be the subject of KGB attention, had the inadequate man's hatred of his own service and country, and agreed to work for Moscow. During the summer of 1968, Karpov trained him personally in East Berlin. getting to know and despise him more. The RAF man's tour in Berlin and his contract in the RAF was coming to a close, and he was due that September of 1968 to return to Britain and demobilisation. It was suggested that on leaving the Air Force he apply for a job at Government Communications HQ at Cheltenham.